Okay, so my name is Coco Wilder, and I'm here with Dr. Terry Phoenix, who is the director of the UNC LGBTQ Center, and it is March 17th, 2014, and we are at the UNC LGBTQ Center. So thank you for meeting with me, Terry. Yeah,
definitely, my pleasure.
I thought before we get started, if you could just tell me how you identify in your own words.
Okay. It's changed a little bit over the years. I think when I first came out in the early 80s, you know, the language was gay. And then in college, the way I would have described myself is a lesbian.
Mm-hmm.
And that started to be less comfortable for me the more that I started to question my gender identity.
Mm-hmm.
And so I started using queer as the term in the late 90s to describe myself. And that, in terms of sexual orientation, queer would be what I would say. And I don't mean it as an umbrella term. I mean it in the fact that of people who challenge the norms about gender and sexuality. So there's a lot of different meanings for queer, and people use that a lot of way. But that's how I use it. And in terms of my gender identity, I always struggled with my identity as a female, as assigned female at birth. And it wasn't until I met some other trans people in the early 2000s, late 90s, early 2000s, and started really building some friendships that I understood what being trans meant. And so started my own sort of questioning and experience of that. And somewhere along about 2005, 2006, I kind of settled on the label of transmasculine. Prior to that, I would have said genderqueer, but so I'm a queer transmasculine person who's married to a woman who identifies as a lesbian, and we have a daughter that we, at least that's, you know, she's only four, so we don't know how she's going to identify herself, but long answer to a short question.
Okay, great. So I guess we'll talk about some of that later. But backing up, can you just kind of tell me something a little bit about your childhood?
Yeah, so I was born in Louisville, Kentucky, and I moved around a lot as a kid. My mom was married five times, and I ultimately ended up leaving home when I was 15. When I came out, she did not, she didn't take that very well. And so we had a lot of tension, and there was a lot of tension in the household anyway. And so that kind of was the straw that broke the camel's back, sort of proverbially. So I left home, and I ended up actually in foster care. And so lived with a couple of different people, finished high school, and then went to ECU. So, played sports, always into sports. In third grade, I remember wanting to play baseball, and they said you can't because you're a girl. And I insisted, and ultimately they let me try out. And then I think the idea was I'll try out and I won't be any good. But I tried out, and they decided I was good, and so they would let me play. So kind of bucking that gender stuff started really early.
Yeah. Can you tell me about the circumstances of your coming out?
Oh, yeah. It's funny because I had been dating a guy, and, mm-hmm. and I was dating this guy named James, and I love him, and we're still in contact today. He and I used to actually go to the gay club. My mom was a police officer, and she picked up extra work working the door of the club in Savannah, Georgia. And so that's sort of was my first exposure to LGBT community, was at the Who's Who in Savannah, Georgia. And so James and I would go there and dance, and my mom figured if we were there, she knew where we were, and we weren't out getting in trouble anywhere. So that's kind of how that started. And so I think that the friendships that I sort of made through being there were the regulars, and there was Kelly who worked behind the bar, and different people, and started me thinking about my own feelings around sexuality. I didn't understand why everybody thought sex was such a great and wonderful thing, because it was okay, it was good, But I didn't understand, you know, it didn't seem to be to me what it was to everybody else. So anyway, James and I ended up breaking up because I sort of started to realize that I like this woman, you know, who I knew from summer camp. And then when I kissed her, it was all bets were off. It was like, oh, that's what I want to do. I get it now. And so James and I broke up. I broke it off with James. And, you know, and we had some usual post-breakup tensions. but, you know, he and I now are very good friends, and it's all worked out okay. We call each other brother and sister just to make it easier for everybody to try to explain, because he ended up coming to live with us. So
yeah. So how old were you when you were like going to a gay club with your boyfriend where your mom was like a bouncer kind of?
Yeah. That was my life. Yeah.
How old were you? You say?
Let's see. 67, 77, 78, 79, 80, 81. So 13, 14 was when that was going on, I guess. Yeah.
And what was the club, like, what was that experience like as a 13-year-old?
Oh, I loved it. I loved it. You know, the women kind of doted on me, and I enjoyed the attention. I mean, they were always a completely appropriate, you know. It was like I was a little kid mascot or something. So, you know, but it was, I don't know. It was like the whole world kind of opened up to me, because I didn't know anything about gay people and didn't know anything about the community. And all of a sudden, here were all these women who were with other women, and they had jobs and they had homes together and they were raising families together, and they would go out and they would party. And I don't know, it was like watching TV in black and white and then all of a sudden getting color, you know. That's kind of how I would describe it, you know. So they taught me to dance, and they, you know, I don't know how to say. It was just fun. It was just being there, and they would tease me, and so.
Yeah. And you said that this boyfriend came to live with you at some point?
Yeah, he came to live with us, I guess when I was 13.
Can you tell me more about the circumstances of that?
Yeah, he had a really bad home life as well, and he had been in a juvenile detention center. And when he came out of the juvenile detention center, his dad did not want him to come and live with him, right? So he couldn't go home. And so my mom took him in at our house so that he'd have some place to live.
Okay. And moving forward, can you tell me about leaving your home and going into the foster care system?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, my mom she was married, and she had been dating this guy kind of on the side, and she disappeared for a couple of days, and the husband to whom she was married was pretty upset and angry about it, and it didn't feel safe to be at home. And he was already upset and angry with me because, in his mind, my coming out was what was destroying the family. And so we had this big, huge fight, and he stormed off, and I decided that I needed to get out of Dodge. And so I packed up some stuff, you know, in a little backpack, and hopped on my little, you know, bicycle and rode into Savannah. And, you know, thinking that I would find one of the folks from the club. And then I realized after I got there that wasn't a good plan, because then my mom would know right where I was. And so then I rode to Statesboro, Georgia, which is, I don't know, about 45 minutes away by car. And I ended up staying there. And I was gone about a week, I guess. And the thing that brought me back was we had qualified for the state championships in softball. And I didn't want to miss the state championships. So I called and I said, I told a friend of Mariana and Coach Height. Coach Height was my softball, cross country, track, basketball coach, and he and his wife had been really great to me, and his oldest daughter and I were really good friends. And so I called a mutual friend or somebody that I knew them, and I said, I'll come home if I can go live with Coach Height and his family. And they told me that, yes, I could. And then when the police came and got me, they didn't follow through on that, obviously. And so it took them a while to get me a foster placement, because I think nobody wanted a teenager who had run away and was a handful. And but they got me, one of my high school teachers said that she would take me in and I could live with her until my court date. And then and then right before the court date, I went back home because it wasn't looking too good for me and I didn't want to go to the juvenile detention center. And my mom said if I came back home, she would drop all the charges that she had the ability to drop, and that would leave me with probation eligible offenses. And then another bit of time goes by and I leave again, and this time I say I'm not going to go back. And so that's when they put me in foster care.
And were the foster families that you stayed with, were they aware of your, like, being gay? Or?
Yeah, the Polks are probably the family that I was with the longest. And they, I don't know if they knew I was gay or not. I know that Miss Polk really, she was kind of challenging because she wanted me to get up and watch the PTL club in the mornings with her, and she was very intent on saving my soul, so probably she knew something. And, you know, she would check to make sure I had a bra on every morning when I left. You know, just little stuff like that was problematic. And I stayed there, it was a year and a half maybe, and then I ended up getting to go live with my coach and his family for the last month or two of high school.
Yeah, what were the coach and softball and baseball, what was your, like, why did athletics matter to you, or why do they matter to you?
I don't know if I can really explain that, you know, I mean, like from the time I was a little kid, like I remember in first grade and getting a basketball, you know, from one of my presents in first grade, and me going out for Christmas, and me going out in the snow in Indiana to shoot hoops. And, you know, I couldn't hit the basketball goal and a regulation goal in first grade, but boy, I stayed out there and tried until my lips were blue and my fingers were numb. And I told you the story about playing baseball, wanting to play baseball in third grade. I was always playing pickup games. It was something that I did well. And I think as a kid, I was really trying to find where did I fit, you know. And because I was good at athletics, that felt like a place I fit. And in high school, it's what made high school doable for me. I was, when I started at Bryan County High School, because there they had like 7th and 8th grade were the middle school, and then 9th through 12 was the high school, and it was all kind of there together, very small town. And, you know, I wanted to be done with school, but you couldn't drop out until you were 16 in Georgia. And so I figured I'll play sports, and that was what I did. I played sports and then ultimately decided to stay in school. Sports made that worthwhile. And I played softball. We won a state championship, and I ran cross country and track and won state championships in both of those, and played basketball and all the way through high school. And then got a scholarship to go to ECU because I wouldn't have been able to go to college otherwise.
Mm-hmm. And what were your relationships like with the women on the softball and basketball teams?
They were really good, you know. I think they were really good. I was out, but it wasn't talked about a lot in high school, other than, you know, I got some harassing and that kind of stuff. But the other women on the team, now, you know, if you look at our high school photograph, there's a bunch of us that are there that ultimately came out, right? But at the time, I was the only one, myself and then Jody, who was the coach's oldest daughter, who I was friends with. So, they were okay with it, but I think everybody struggled with, they don't want to be picked on too, and so they don't want to be the friend of the gay person. Mm-hmm. But they were my friends, and it just was complicated a little bit.
Yeah. Can you tell me more about your friendship with Jody?
Yeah, I love Jody. She has known me almost the longest of anybody. She and my friend Lee have known me the longest. And the first time I met Jody, I was sitting in the library at the high school, Bryan County High School. And this girl comes in with an orange football jersey on, and she looks at me and she says, "Are you Terry Lynch?" And I said, "Yeah." Like, what of it? And she said, "Follow me." And that was our first interaction, right? You know, this real, like, both of us, And, but then we ended up playing ball together. And somehow, I can't tell you how we became friends, but somehow, I think part of it was playing ball together. Part of it was her coach or her dad, you know, my coach, would give me rides back to my house because my parents didn't come get me a lot. And so he found out that I had been running back to the house, you know, or bumming rides. And so he started taking people, and I was one of those people. And I think the thing that cemented our friendship probably is we went out to Pizza Hut as a team, or not as a team, but it was Jody and me and several people from the team and Jody's cousin Paula, and we ended up just having a great time and laughing, and you know, laugh so hard you squirt soda out your nose, and you know, and that from then on it was just like after practice I would go with Jody to her grandmother's house, and you know, that friendship just developed from there. And she and I went to the same college, and we both moved to the Triangle area, and she lives, you know, on the other side of Durham from me, but we get together every Sunday morning and have breakfast. So Sunday mornings at 8:30, you'll find us at Elmo's.
That's so nice. Does she have a family here?
She's married to a woman named Beth, and they have three dogs. Their children have four legs.
Aww.
So there's two little Yorkies and a big black lab mix, and who is just as sweet as can be. So they have four-legged critters, and you know, we have a four-legged critter, one four-legged critter, and one two-legged critter.
Gosh, that's the best. Goals. Anyway, lifelong friendships. But can you tell me now about your early time at ECU, like how you got to ECU?
So got to ECU, as I said, on a scholarship for softball and cross country. And you know, I was a dual sport athlete for 2 years, and you know, being a dual sport scholarship athlete is not an easy thing. And for me, after 2 years, I decided I just wanted to do one sport. And so I stopped doing softball and just ran cross country. And that was a full-time job in and of itself, plus classes, plus I worked, you know, because my scholarship paid for almost everything. I had to pay a little bit of tuition and then my food and books and stuff, right? So I still had to work, but the scholarship covered most of it.
So. Were you at all, what were your communities? Who were your friends?
Well, my friends were really the softball team.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, the friendships that I made all ended up pretty much being, all of them ended up being through the softball team. And then people that followed the softball team. My cross country teammates and I we spent a lot of time together running. I mean, when you're running 20 miles once a week, you spend a lot of time together, but we didn't do a lot outside of the practices and the competition. So, Yeah, it was really the softball team that formed the core of my friendship group. And then there were some other people. I was a little wild child for a few years when I was in college. So I had my drinking partners and my partying partners. And so those were the two main kind of groups of folks. And then I went through a phase where I was struggling with my sexual orientation. Because like, when I first came out, I didn't have any conflicts about my sexual orientation. But as I had gotten to know more Jody's parents, I started going to church with them and so started identifying as a Christian. And their church was really cool because, you know, they had cool music. They fed people who were hungry, you know, helped build some habitat houses, I think. And it just wasn't my sexuality wasn't an issue. When I got to college, when I started going to church in my junior year, I ended up getting kicked out of a church because of my sexual orientation. So I went through this period of time where I wondered, well, is it wrong to be gay? You know, and I wanted to have my Christian identity, and that identity conflicted with sexual orientation in ways that, to my mind, I didn't know about all the passages they used to condemn homosexuality until they started using them toward me.
Mm-hmm.
And so for a brief little period, there was InterVarsity Christian Fellowship and a group of people that I knew through there. So those are kind of my, I guess, three friend groups.
Okay. I want to come back to, like, a couple of those things. But your partying days, like, who was, like, did you participate at all in, like, gay party scenes? Or, like, what?
Oh, yeah.
Like,
yeah.
Sexuality-wise, like, what was
there
your
were a lot of
life?
There were a lot of house parties.
Yeah?
Yeah, a lot of house parties. There was one, and there was one gay, well, there were two gay bars in Greenville, I think, when I first moved there. And so there was a lot of going out to the gay bars and watching the shows and drinking and dancing and, you know, all the things that happen in clubs. And I partook, liberally, and, you know, just really, I was a college student, with feeling like I was set free on the world, you know, with a little bit of money in my pocket and no supervision, and so could do pretty much whatever I wanted to. And so a big part of my, you know, it's like I got up in the morning and ran or swam or biked, and then I went to classes, and then until it was time to go back to practice. And then after practice, I would go to work, you know, from 8 or 9 to midnight, and then at midnight I would get off and either go to somebody's house where we'd be partying, or I'd go out, meet them at the club. And so that was a pretty typical Thursday, Friday, Saturday night. So for 3 years, I would say. Yeah, 3 years. Because my senior year, I didn't really do that a lot.
That sounds exhausting.
It was exhausting. It was exhausting. I didn't have a whole lot of social life, as you can tell from that description of my days. But yeah, I managed to find time to get in trouble. And the other thing that happened, I think the other thing that was my social life was we were trying to get a gay and lesbian organization started. There was a couple other people that, along with me, were trying to get a gay and lesbian organization recognized through the student union. And they were just not interested in recognizing us. And we couldn't get whatever the minimum number of people to sign on the roster, so we couldn't have one. And because we didn't have one, we couldn't get people to join what we were doing. And so we would meet at one of the women had an apartment off campus. And so we went through this elaborate posting flyers with a phone number, and then when they'd call the phone number, you know, it would come to me, and I would screen them to make sure that it was a legit call, and then I would tell them where her house was and when we were meeting, right? This is before internet and cell phones and all that kind of stuff. And so, you know, that's how we sort of tried to get a little group together going.
Mm-hmm. And who came up with this, like, can you tell me more about the experience of trying to lobby this group into existence?
Yeah.
Did you have any support from people?
We went, there were three of us. There were three of us, three women. And there was one guy that was sort of, I think, partially in the mix too, but he didn't really do a lot. And I'm trying to think of their names, and I can't. One of them is Bonnie, and I can't remember the other woman's name right now to say my neck. So, but yeah, we went to the student union and asked about, you know, how do you reserve a room? That was the first thing, you know, is that we wanted to have a room in the student union so we could have a place to meet. And they said, you can't unless you're a recognized student organization. And so we said, well, how do we do that? And so they told us you need to have at least, I can't remember how many people it was on a roster, in order to be able to be recognized. And, you know, they were very inflexible about that. I found out later, as I was trying to get 10 names, that there were other student organizations that didn't have 10 names on their roster, you know, but they kind of let that go. They didn't let that go for us. And they also did not seem very open to having a gay and lesbian group as a recognized student organization. This is still, you know, this is mid to late 80s.
Mm-hmm.
And it's also the time around the HIV/AIDS epidemic. And so we got to factor all of that in together. Because that was, you know, in the 89 was when really I started seeing HIV and AIDS start to decimate a lot of the community around in this area, at least the people that I knew.
Mm-hmm. And you told me about the flyers that directed people to this meeting.
Yeah. Since we couldn't meet in the union, we decided that we would meet in her house, in Bonnie's house, apartment. And so then we were like, well, we don't want to just post, you know, gay and lesbian meeting here at this place in this time, because we were afraid, right? You know, we thought that people might harass us or somebody might, you know, come and vandalize her house. And so we needed to have a way that people could find out where the meeting was. And so I devised this idea of, well, let's put a phone number on the flyer, you know, and it was like gay and lesbian interest meeting. And then the phone number, and, you know, call for more information. That was pretty much the extent of the flyer. And so we put those up around campus. And then the number was to my dorm room.
Mm-hmm.
So.
And were most of the calls that you got, were they legit, or?
We got a lot of harassing and prank calls.
Mm-hmm.
And I it's been so long now that I couldn't tell you what the percentage was, but we got a lot of calls that were definitely not legit.
Mm-hmm. And what would you do at the house meetings?
Well, mostly it ended up being just the three of us that were trying to make this happen. And so we kept trying to figure out how we could get more people, because we knew, like, all of us knew gay people,
yeah.
Right? Like, most of the ones that I knew were on the softball team,
mm-hmm.
right? Sometimes the stereotypes are
right.
true. But the folks on the softball team weren't really interested in being in a gay and lesbian organization. Like, that just wasn't something. They had their niche,
mm-hmm.
and, you know, and that was, I mean, when I was my first and second year there, when I was on the team, that was my group of folks too. When I dropped down to just doing cross country, I didn't feel like I fit in that crowd of people in the same way. And so that's what kind of led me to try to find a way to create a network of gay people.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what this was attempting to do. And so Bonnie, I met through, I think, a class. I can't remember how I met Bonnie now.
Mm-hmm.
But, and we started talking and finally came out to each other and decided, you know, why don't we try this? So.
That's cool. So you were doing this, like, what point in your college career?
Probably in my junior year.
Okay, and how did that match up with this time when you were kicked out of this church?
Yeah, what's really interesting is that it lines up perfectly.
Yeah.
Because, somewhere in my junior year was when that getting, and they didn't, they would probably say we didn't kick you out. What they said was, you can't come back until you agree to participate in a healing service and give your life to Jesus and stop being gay.
Mm-hmm.
Right? That's what, essentially, if I was gay, then I was out.
Mm-hmm.
And so I would try not to be gay, right? I would not go out to the club. I would not, like, date anybody. I would try to get all things gay out of my head, right? And mm-hmm. and it didn't work. It didn't work, you know? And then I would give up and be like, okay, I'm gay. And then I would miss having a spiritual community, and then I would try again, you know? And so my whole junior year was really a lot of that junior year was framed in that struggle.
Mm-hmm.
And then through, and also through my senior year as well. And University Christian Fellowship was a good place to find a spiritual community, but I couldn't bring being gay there.
Mm-hmm.
So I really struggled to find a place that felt like I fit. And the place that I found in my senior year that I felt like I fit, my late in my junior and early in my senior year, was ACT UP. There wasn't an ACT UP organization at ECU, but there was in Atlanta, and I had found out about it. And so there was one in Atlanta, one in D.C., and so I would go to different actions in my senior year.
Can you tell me what ACT UP is?
ACT UP, AIDS Coalition to Unleash Power.
Okay.
And ACT UP was an organization that tried to raise awareness about the HIV/AIDS epidemic that was happening. Because, you know, in the 80s when this was happening, it wasn't being talked about.
Mm-hmm.
And even in the early 90s, it wasn't being talked about. The federal government wasn't allocating resources to try to do research to find a cure. You know, it wasn't until, I think, 91 that it was that an elected official actually said HIV. It wasn't named until, I can't forget that history right off the top of my head. But the CDC didn't have a name for it for a mm-hmm. long time. It was a really time where not only were gay people not accepted and not seen, but they were seen as the carriers of this plague that was deadly. And so there were friends of mine who contracted AIDS and were in the hospital, and the nurses didn't want to touch them because they feared that they would catch AIDS. And so we would set up, you know, we would set a schedule with different shifts to sit with people and make sure that they got water or they, you know, got bathed or just had somebody there with them to do whatever they needed to have done and make sure they got treated well. So, and you know, that is stuff that I think the ACT UP organizations that I sort of started to be more and more involved with kind of opened my eyes to.
What other actions would you do through ACT UP?
So the one that I remember most was one in Burroughs Welcome, where we pretty much shut them down for a couple hours one afternoon because they had found, I think it was Burroughs Welcome, I think was what they were called at the time. They had found a cure, or not a cure, they had found the AZT medication, which was the first medication that gave you a shot at not having a death sentence from AIDS. But it was priced so high that, and the insurance companies weren't covering it. And so here was this potentially life-saving medication that we felt the drug company had and was trying to make a profit rather than being focused on addressing the epidemic. And so one of the actions was going, and this is, again, we don't have the internet, which would have made it organizing a whole lot easier. So we did everything through newsletters. And so there was an action that got planned to go and lay down across the road where the service delivery trucks came in, where their shipping trucks came in and out, and lay down across the road in like five deep and prevent that road. Basically, like, you have to run over us if you're going to take your trucks in and out. And we had enough people. We had a couple busloads, and we had enough people that when the police, like, carted somebody away, somebody else would come and take their place. And so that we would do actions like that. And so that's one that I was at, and I remember vividly. We would have, you know, one of the things that people did a lot was, you know, take red paint and use it and sort of symbolically make it look like blood. We did die-ins, did a lot of die-ins to represent how many people die every second, every minute. So there were a lot of those. Yeah.
How did you find out about this organization or get involved?
I think when I came, I was dating a woman here in Chapel Hill. And there used to be a woman's bookstore in Durham. And I'm trying to think of the name of that.
I know it, too. And it has a hilarious name.
Yeah.
It's, like, really, Sister, it's like a pie. Is it baking related? I don't know.
I can't remember, but, yeah. But there was...
I know
it was downtown near where
the
old Durham Bulls park used to be.
Mm-hmm.
So there was that, and then there was also this place that was, I think it was called Our Own Place, that met. It was like a women's lesbian drop-in hangout. They would have musicians there and game nights there and that kind of stuff. And so so I ended up going to one of those, and they had all these flyers, mm-hmm. you know, and all these newsletters and all that kind of stuff. And so that's how I found out about ACT UP, was through newsletters at one of those two places. Our Own Place, I think.
Can you tell me about moving to Chapel Hill then?
Yeah, I moved here for a woman. I did, it's true. I was dating this woman named Sharon at the time, and she was a student here at UNC, and I had some connections with UNC through some of the anti-apartheid organizing mm-hmm. that had taken place, been also a little involved with that. Not in any big way. I didn't organize anything. I just came to demonstrations and stuff. But yeah, she lived in, what's that, the group of dorms, res halls that are over there behind where the library is. There's a G. Grimes. That's where she lived. She lived in Grimes. And so so I wanted to be near her. And so after I graduated, I got a job working at Wright School Reeducation Center in Durham and dated Sharon. And then, you know, the relationship broke up, but I stayed here anyway because there was some cool stuff that was happening and I had a job and, you know, so...
So how did you meet Sharon? You mentioned...
Through summer camp. Yeah, we worked summer camp. Summer camp was very important in my life. You know, that's the first crush I ever had, you know, was at summer camp, was on a counselor at summer camp, and, you know, and then grew up and worked at summer camps, and so summer camp was a big thing. So, yes, Sharon and I had met at summer camp, and she actually didn't identify as a lesbian, so I was an exception in her life. And that ultimately was why we ended up breaking up, because she just wasn't okay with it. The conflict between her spirituality and sexuality was such that she just couldn't do that. And I, by that time, had already found St. John's MCC, which is a non-denominational Christian church predominantly for LGBT people.
Can you tell me more about Our Own Place?
Yeah, they had a pool table. There was this old house, and you walk in, and it had, like, this living room den, all one sort of big open space. And that's where they would have, whenever they had musicians come, they would have the musicians be in that front area there. And then you walk down the hall, a little short hall, and there's a kitchen. And then off to the left was this little game room area that had the pool table in it. And then there was a backyard that you could go out, and that's all the smokers went and smoked out back a lot. And I mean, you smoked in the house too. Like, it wasn't, you know, like today where people don't smoke in people's houses or whatever. You know, you smoked everywhere then. And yeah, and it was just neat. You know, you could go and they'd advertise potlucks and everybody come and bring their food, and you know, you'd eat and you'd maybe listen to some music, you'd play games, play board games, you know, play cards. I played a lot of cards. And you just talk to folks. Yeah. And there was the music store. Not the music store, but it was the publisher of women's music.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, I have to look it up. I can't remember. Lady Slipper.
Lady Slipper. Yeah. That was the bookstore, right? Or no?
Mm-mm. It wasn't the name of the bookstore, but that was the name of the company that would, like, promote women's music.
Mm-hmm.
Here in Durham. It was a locally owned.
Okay.
I almost want to say the bookstore's name was Southern Sister.
Yeah. I just know because I looked up the other day, like, to see if there, like, existed a feminist bookstore in the Triangle, and, like, that was the thing that came up, was mm-hmm. this place in Durham, but it seemed like it didn't exist anymore.
Yeah,
it had these, like, remnants of an online presence.
Yeah.
Yeah,
and it was a cool little bookstore. It, too, was in an old house.
Mm-hmm.
And so you walk in, and there's the cash register there on your left, and you walk in, and it had this lovely, what I know now is probably mold smell, but, you know, it was just, it felt comfortable, and you walked in, and there's, like, just the whole downstairs was nothing but books. Everywhere you looked, bookcases, books. And they had a little kitchen in the back, so you could, like, make yourself a cup of tea, and then, you know, sit there and read your book. And people would gather sometimes at the bookstore, and they'd have different readings and different discussions and that kind of stuff. So mm-hmm. it was another little hub of activity.
And what kind of books or what kind of information were you looking for at this time?
I think a lot of times I just wanted to go there just because it was a place that was gay. You know mm-hmm. what I mean? Like, it was a place, even though it wasn't gay, I mean, it was a women's bookstore. It wasn't a gay bookstore, but they had a lot of LGBT literature, you know, and books. And so I remember getting Ruby Fruit Jungle from that bookstore, you know, and the two women that worked there, and I don't know, they may have been the owners, but the two women that worked there, I struck up a friendship with them. And a lot of times I'd go and spend an hour or so before I'd go into work. You know, I worked 2 to midnight at the Wright School Reeducation Center. And so a lot of times I'd go to karate in the morning and then shower and then go and spend a couple hours there and then, you know, go into work. So I just wanted to be around other people that were gay.
Yeah, absolutely.
Because I was around people that were straight all the time.
I know. Right? did you at all interact with, I guess you were living in Durham, with student organizations either at Duke or at UNC?
The student organization that I interacted with most was probably BSM around the anti-apartheid actions that they did in that period of time. There wasn't really, after I had moved here, I sort of was more involved in ACT UP than I was anything else. And so mm-hmm. there wasn't really, to my knowledge, I didn't know about whatever presence was here on this campus, because I wasn't dating anybody on this campus now, so I didn't have any connection to it.
Mm-hmm. What were the anti-apartheid protests that you participated in?
Well, I remember a lot of meetings to talk about what would be effective, you know, mm-hmm. and there were a lot of things that I couldn't come to because we competed on the weekends. And then a lot of things that happened in the middle of the day, if I couldn't get away from class or practice, I couldn't come here. So a lot of it was, I helped with the letter writing and stuffing things. I remember coming to a couple of demonstrations on Polk Place, you know, and holding signs and all that kind of stuff.
And with ACT UP, I know you're involved with that, but how did you see, like, AIDS impact you on a more, like, personal, like, friendship, relational level?
I went to a lot of funerals.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, the early 90s, I went to a lot of funerals. And, you know, I'm sorry, I get teared up. I'm just thinking about my friends, you know. Even though there was some medication that could help people live longer, a lot of my friends didn't have that money. They didn't have insurance. And so they couldn't afford it. And so, you know, it was, back then, it was a death sentence. I mean, it was like when you hear terminal cancer, when you hear someone say terminal cancer these days, you know, that's the equivalent of hearing, you know, I'm HIV positive or I've got AIDS. And so, you know, you try to be there for your friends. And like I talked about, you know, we would create these rotating shifts of people to sit with people in the hospital or go sit with them at their house, and try to keep them comfortable and try to make sure they were treated with dignity and respect. And it was hard, too, because a lot of people weren't out to their families. And so, you know, you had to kind of navigate keeping the gay people away from the family people, because how would you explain how you knew them, you know? And so that was challenging. And then there were people who died who, you know, because they had such an issue with the sexuality of the person, they would say they died of pneumonia, but not say that it was AIDS-related. And they would say, you know, family only to the funeral. So none of us would get to go. And so we went to funerals, but we also did a lot of memorial services at people's houses in honor of someone whose funeral we couldn't go to. Yeah, I went to a lot of funerals. Yeah. And I remember when I found out about the AIDS quilt. I think it was 93. It was the first time the quilt was assembled in totality, mm-hmm, on the National Mall. And I remember going up for that. And I remember a couple of my friends had panels, that one of whom I'd helped make the panel and or contributed to the panel. And so I remember going up there for that. And, you know, I can't even tell you, like, how sobering that was to stand at one end of the National Mall and look down and you saw this quilt, you know, all the way. And it was full, and there were people, you know, mourning and crying and singing, and, you know, it was, I think that was when I knew that it was bad. I knew that AIDS had really taken a toll, but I don't think it was until that moment, standing on the National Mall and looking, that I was overcome with grief by how many people had died. I mean, we lost a good portion of a generation, you know?
I guess moving away.
Yeah, it's hard to move from there, huh? I get that.
If you feel like we're at a good, like,
yeah, no, that's place to, that's a,
yeah, to move. Yeah, it just reminds, like, my mom's best friends, like, died of AIDS in a really small rural town in Louisiana, and, like, a lot of the stuff, like, that you were describing with the family and, mm-hmm, no one knowing what happened and that he was sick until it was just like,
mm-hmm,
just reminds me of Kevin. But I guess moving more in the 2000s, when you said that you started to attend or like kind of become aware of like trans communities and, mm-hmm, issues, can you tell me like how did that happen?
Yeah, it actually started happening, I'm trying to remember when this was. I think it was in the mid-90s. I kind of was involved in two different startup groups for LGBT organizations. One of them became the Gay and Lesbian Adolescent Support System Services. I can't remember what the second S stood for, but GLASS in, mm-hmm. in Greensboro area. And we tried to do basically what I had found in our own place. We tried to do that in Greensboro for LGBT youth. And then also the Rainbow Youth Coalition, which later became North Carolina Lambda Youth Network. So it was kind of still had a foot here, even though in 92 I had moved to Greensboro. So I did a lot of driving. But I just felt really strongly about trying to make space for youth, because by that point I had known a couple of youth who had committed suicide, and I'd known several of my friends who had attempted, all around this conflict between either their racial or ethnic identity and their sexuality, or their religious spiritual identity and sexuality. And so I really felt moved to try to do something for that. And what I saw a lot was I was also at the first major March on Washington for LGBT folks. And leading up to that, and throughout a lot of the organizing in the 90s, when people tried to organize for visibility for LGBT people, it was really LGB people. And so they would, the organizers, a lot of events would say, you know, be mindful about how you present yourself, you know, and they didn't want drag queens showing up, you know, and they didn't want people, and that's how I thought about folks, drag queens and drag kings, you know, and I look at it now, and a lot of those people probably were trans, you know, but it just didn't register on my radar. And so, and some of them were, you know, reasonably decent friends of mine, you know, like I didn't know them really, really well, but, you know, I don't know, it was the ways in which there were limits on who was welcome and how you were welcome started being a sore point for me. And I remember finding out about the Southern Comfort Conference. And so in 2000 was the first year I went to the Southern Comfort Conference. And I met all of these wonderful trans-identified people and started talking to them, you know, like listening in the sessions that I went to and then talking to people in between sessions. And it was like, oh my God, that's my experience. You know, it just resonated in the same way that, you know, kissing a woman was like, oh yeah, that's what I want to do. It was like, oh, this resonates for me. And it started to make sense for me, but there weren't really trans organizations. Certainly none in the 90s. That I knew of. I mean, there were probably underground, you know, locally known about groups, but there weren't a lot that, you know, were on the web that you could find and all that kind of stuff. The first group I ever went to was a group in Atlanta, and they were pretty dead set that they wanted people who were trans men. And they wanted people who identified as male and who were going to change their gender marker to male. And at that point, you know, I wasn't sure what I was going to do vis-a-vis my gender marker. I had been binding my breasts for years, but didn't know about top surgery as an option. And so was trying to figure out, well, what did I want to do that or not, you know? And so I was disinvited from the trans meeting because I wasn't sort of moving in that direction of the purpose of that group. So that sort of set me back a little bit. And I had trans friends that I talked to and kept in touch with, but I wasn't really involved in any trans organization through that time. I was very involved in 2000, I moved down to Georgia, to University of Georgia, and I was very involved in getting their Safe Space program up and running again, and in the advocacy work around getting a center because they didn't have a center when I was down there. And so spent a lot of time trying to advocate for both of those things and trying to do it from a place that included all voices, you know, that the trans people could be included in there as well. So, yeah, and there was a trans community that I knew through the bars in Atlanta.
Yeah. Wow, there's, like, so much work that's been done around, like, I mean...
Oh, yeah, yeah. There's a tremendous amount of work and visibility that has been done around trans identities and trans communities. I mean, because it really was not on the radar, even in 2000.
Yeah. I mean, obviously, like, miles and bounds and to go, but wow, yeah.
And I started working here in 2005.
Yeah.
And by that point, really solidly identified as a genderqueer trans person.
Mm-hmm.
And so started trying to raise the conversation in this area about trans identities and trans visibility and trying to find groups and trying to support groups and just get involved.
How'd you go about doing that, trying to start that conversation?
Well, on campus, one of the first things I did was trying to find a gender non-specific bathroom, because bathrooms are a challenge for trans people and gender non-conforming people in general. Because you go into a bathroom and people are trying to figure out, are you in the right one or the wrong one? You know, so you get stared at. Sometimes I had actually had security called on me a couple of places, and you know, once here at Chapel Hill, once at University of Georgia, you know, often had people ask me if I'm in the wrong place, or, you know, I mean, it's a common occurrence, and certainly after top surgery, it has happened more than it did before. So when I got here, I started that conversation. We were in the basement of Steel Building, and there was a single stall locking bathroom, and it was labeled by gender. And it's like, well, why are we labeling a single stall locking bathroom by gender? Like, that doesn't make sense. You go in, you lock the door, you go to the bathroom. That didn't make sense to me. And so starting that conversation was a big part of what I did that first year that I was here. The other thing I did in trying to find community was there was a woman named Leah Vici who I knew. She had transitioned while she was here in the computer science department, and so she was very visible both in the community and on campus. And so I made connection with her and you know, sort of got a history of kind of what had been going on and how, where the lay of the land was, that kind of stuff. And really started to push people to talk about trans communities. We brought Underground Transit here my first year. We've brought Bear Bergman. You know, we've done a number of big speakers that have come. We've got, I'm proud to say, growing out of the work of that first year, we have in the design regulations for UNC Chapel Hill, the design guide, which is the guide you have to abide by when you're doing any major build or any major renovation, they have in there that you have to have at least one gender non-specific bathroom if you're doing a major renovation or new build. And so, you know, I'm happy with at least one. You know, at least there's one in every building, and hopefully that will... You know, we continue to try to lobby to have single stall bathrooms labeled just as bathrooms, and so we're going to continue to try to get that done. The other thing that we've done a lot, and I say we because it hasn't just been me; it's been a network of people that I've worked with. But the other thing that we've really focused on is trying to increase the cultural competency, the knowledge base around trans communities at the Campus Health Center. And to get hormone replacement therapy to be something that our health center offers. They don't do surgery for anyone, but, you know, they do hormones, is my understanding. And so if they do hormones for a cisgender male who has low testosterone, I don't see why they can't do it for a transgender male who would have low testosterone without treatment. Same thing with estrogens. You know, if you're going to do that, then do it across the board. So we'll keep working on that, and we'll also keep working on the exclusions on healthcare. So for trans people, like right now, the way it is in our student health insurance, if a person is a trans man, the health insurance won't pay for pap smears or GYN exams. Even though they still have a vagina, they still have a uterus, the insurance won't cover it because they're legally male. And that's a problem. You know, I mean, that's a big problem. And so trying to organize to get those policies changed. And then about 3 or 4 years ago, we started Trans Talk Tuesdays. And so that's it's the second and fourth Tuesday is a sort of peer support discussion group. And it usually takes place at Open Eye Cafe. And we like doing it in the community because it's open not just to students, but it's also open to staff, faculty, community members, alumni, pretty much anyone who wants to go. Yeah. And when we structured it very intentionally to be the broadest definition of trans that there is. I didn't want anyone to have the experience that I had of someone judging whether I was trans enough. You know, and I didn't want that to happen for people here. And so we were very clear as we facilitated it and very clear in our advertising that it was for people who identify anywhere on the trans asterisk spectrum or if you're questioning your gender identity. And we opened it also to intersex people because I think in many, many ways intersex communities have a similar challenge around space acquisition and use and the gender binary.
Absolutely. Yeah, I see those on that chalkboard. What brought you though to UNC?
The LGBTQ Center.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's what brought me was the job. I was finishing my dissertation or collecting data for my dissertation, and I was paying the bills used by doing construction work, drywalling and demo. And then I had a ladder accident and fell 20 feet and was pretty busted up. And so obviously couldn't work construction for a while and started talking to people in my network of friends. And one of them was Dean Blackburn, who is an assistant dean of students. And he was also affiliated with the LGBTQ Center. The director was leaving, and so he was working with the administration to try to find an interim director. And they had a graduate assistant position open. And so he told me about the graduate assistant position, and I applied for it, and I got it. So I like to tell people I literally fell into this job.
And what was it like working at the center just as it was its own entity, like right at the beginning?
It was exciting. You know, I mean, I think we're celebrating our 10th anniversary this year, and I realized that this is my 9th year.
Yeah.
So I've been here almost since the very beginning of the center. And, you know, it was really exciting in that the center wasn't established yet. I mean, like, they didn't have traditional routine things that they did every year. It was still very much in flux. We had Safe Zone. Safe Zone had started in 1998. And so Safe Zone was pretty firmly established. But there weren't any records. Like, we didn't keep a list of allies, you know, and I'm like, well, we ought to keep a list, you know, and we ought to post that list so people know who the allies are if they want to find them. You know, I mean, like, all of the things that we sort of do every year now, National Coming Out Day, you know, and there had National Coming Out Day programs before, but we didn't at that time participate in a lot of orientation programs. And now we participate in all the orientation programs. We're at a lot of the welcome back events. I talk to the first-year football team players, you know, every year. We just are much more involved and integrated into the everyday workings. I serve on a ton of committees. I didn't serve on any committees at first because no one knew about the LGBTQ Center, right? And so we weren't represented on committees. And so getting known enough to be added to committee work has been a big, was a big task in those first couple of years. But yeah, it was exciting because I got to make it, you know, really what I wanted it to be.
And what did you want it to be?
Well, I wanted it to be a hub. I wanted it to be an information hub, first and foremost. And I wanted it to be a place that talked about not just sexual orientation and gender identity, but I wanted it also to be a place that addressed the issues of racism and classism and ableism and ageism, because all of those things are present in communities, in every community, and the gay community is no exception. And so I had dated a woman who was African-American when I was in college, who really opened my eyes to what white privilege was. And she and I, in our dating relationship, really had a hard time finding a place where we could both be there and feel welcome. You know, it was either like we were in a predominantly black community where being gay was not okay, and my whiteness was an issue, or we were in predominantly white LGB community where there was a lot of racism, unexamined racism. And then she didn't feel fully included and welcomed. So I think that really sensitized me, that and the anti-apartheid work that I had done, my involvement in that really made me aware of how the more marginalized identities someone holds, the harder it is to find a place that they can bring all of who they are. And I wanted the LGBTQ Center to be a place where people could bring all of who they are. And that was really important to me. And so if you go back and you look at all of our history of events, we almost always address an intersecting identity community. You know, when we talk about National Coming Out Day, it's usually done, we've done it in partnership with the American Indian Center and in the Carolina Latino Collaborative, and either screened videos that talk about that intersection or done some program that recognizes that those intersecting identities. And I'm really proud of that. You know, I hope that it feels like a place that people can bring all of who they are. That's really one of the things I wanted to make it be. And the other thing I would say is that I wanted it to be not just for LGBT people, you know? I wanted it to be for people of all sexual orientations, gender identities, and gender expressions, because I think everybody suffers from when heterosexism is enforced, everybody suffers. You know, if you're straight, it still makes you leery, especially if you're a guy, of being affectionate with anyone, because your sexuality might come in question, you know? If you're affectionate with someone of the same gender as you. If you don't like the things that men are supposed to like or women are supposed to like, you know, all that kind of stuff. So I wanted it to be a place where everybody could buy in and see how heterosexism as a system of oppression and the rigid enforcement of the gender binary was problematic.
Yeah. Where do you see it going? Like, what are your, next 10 years? I don't know.
Oh, gosh.
Hope streams.
Yeah, it's been interesting because I've been doing a lot of reflecting on that this year. My ultimate goal is that a center like this isn't needed, because society will be to a point where people aren't marginalized on the basis of their sexual orientation or gender identity. I think that's not going to happen in the next 10 years. We're making a lot of strides. You know, I mean, I think the work around marriage equality has been really phenomenal to see happen, but you know, we still have a tremendous amount of unemployment within the community. We still have a tremendous amount of employment discrimination. We still have a tremendous amount of discrimination in housing and banking and all of those things, and healthcare. There's a lot of health disparities, and when you look for trans people, all of that is even elevated more. You know, when you have, it's a diagnosable disorder to be trans, and there's a debate in the community about if that is a useful thing or not a useful thing, because some people say we're just part of the diversity of gender, you know, that exists. And some people say, well, it's good that it is a diagnosis because that's how I get my insurance to pay for my hormones. You know, so there's a debate there, but, you know, I think it's going to be a long time before people just get to be who they are and don't get marginalized for it. So as long as that is the case, then I want the center to be here and to be visible and to be strong and to be a place that supports people and works actively to deconstruct all those systems of oppression.
Yeah. Is there anything else that you thought I would ask about or you want to talk about for your life history?
Life history. I'm still working on it.
Abridged.
Yeah, I abridged and I'm still working on it. I think one of the only things that we haven't touched on is I have concerns for how the LGBTQ community treats our seniors, those who went before us. I feel like that's a population that is often invisible and made rendered invisible. There's such a youth emphasis on youth and fitness and attractiveness and, you know, all that kind of stuff, body image stuff, that I think that in a lot of LGBT spaces, you know, our seniors who did a lot of the work that we get to enjoy the benefit of are not recognized and aren't included. And I am saddened and angered by that. And so I think that's one thing that I would want to sort of put a note in, so at least somewhere it is recognized, you know, that not everybody has forgotten them.
Mm-hmm.
So.
And do you have, like, are you thinking of any particular, like, relationships or people, older LGBT folks who are important to you?
Well, you know, I mean, I think AIDS took away a lot of people that would be my age or a decade ahead of me. But I think about my friend George, you know, who was out and visible, and he's dead now. But, you know, he wasn't going to apologize for who he was. You know, that's just the way it was. He was in business for himself. And so, you know, he had every reason to say, well, I can't be out, you know, because I'll lose customers. But he didn't do that, you know. And I am, those people are the people that I want to model myself after. You know, the Del Martin, Phyllis Lyon, you know, those folks that back in the day, I mean, they started Daughters of Bilitis, you know, like back in the 50s, they were doing organizing and action. I mean, people that think the LGBT movement started with Stonewall are sorely mistaken, because our forebears have been working on these issues for years and years and years and years and years.
Absolutely.
And I think that, you know, that's one of the things that I would like to see. I would like to see a history of our movement that doesn't start with Stonewall, you know, because there's the Compton riots preceded Stonewall and, you know, a number of different things that preceded Stonewall. But I think the people that write the history or the people that get contacted for the history really shape the history. You know, and so I think our history is reflective of the people that had the means to create a written record or an audio or a visual record. And I'm hopeful that now with, you know, how easily you can put your own stuff on the web, I'm hopeful that the history that is getting written about this time period or that will be written about this time period is more reflective of the diversity of the folks involved and the issues that were raised.
Yeah, and it's also such a struggle, like, as, like a researcher to go back far in the narrative and find people, because, like, just the labels that we have changed so much and the way people tag themselves, and you don't want to, like, at least I don't want to, like, retroactively assign these identities to people, but you also want to document that, like, we've been here forever, you know? Like, how, and then, like you said, the more levels of marginalized identities people hold, like, the harder it has been historically and presently for them to come out as some sort of variant on sexuality or gender, you know?
Yeah, and I think the time, you know, before the internet is really hard to do research on, because nobody, you know, like, nobody, I mean, I have some scrapbooks out there from ACT UP, and, you know, What would I do with them? Well, I finally found out that Wilson Library is going to take them.
I said digitize them.
You know? but there's a lot of stuff that I've had over the years that, you know, just got recycled because, well, you know, there's so much history is lost, you know. We don't have a written record that you can go back to, and we don't have people who lived it, you know, increasingly. So.
Yeah.
So I'm happy that this project is happening, because, you know, at least there's some record of folks.
Yeah. So you were going to tell me about North Carolina Safe School.
Yeah, so I completely forgot about some of the organizing that I did around safe schools. So a friend of mine started a nonprofit called Safe Schools North Carolina. And the idea of that program was to do education in the school system so that schools, you know, high schools, middle schools, K through 12, would be more welcoming and inclusive places for LGBT people and LGBT families And so I was involved with that for a little while and served as the chair of the board for that for a year or two. I can't remember how many years it was. But we did a lot of statewide organizing across the, you know, to try to get the State Board of Education to have a more inclusive non-discrimination policy that was enumerated categories and that would include sexual orientation and gender identity. And then the other thing that that came out of that organizing is the School Violence Prevention Act, which is it prevents violence and it enumerates categories, which we know from research is more effective than just a general you can't discriminate. And it requires mandates teaching and education and training for school personnel. And so that act has been something that has really made possible additional education to get into the K through 12 school systems, which is a place where it's really needed. When you look at the GLSEN School Climate Survey, you know, we see that our high schools in particular and middle schools are really places where people get harassed a lot. And that's a really formative time. Because based on what your K through 12 experiences are, it sets you up to either pursue college, post-secondary education, or not, or whether even you already want to pursue post-secondary education. So so that's another piece of my life that that I had forgotten to talk about.
And what did your role in that organizing and policy building look like?
So I did a lot of presenting in school systems, and we had an internship program where we had students pursue a research project. And so we did a climate survey. We tried to do a climate survey of the whole state, and then that broke down. And so we did a climate survey of the Triangle High Schools. And so we published that in 2005. And you can find that on ERIC. And as I said, a lot of it was trying to do networking across the state to work at those bigger picture policy level items. So lots of meetings, lots of driving, and lots of presentations.
You did a lot of driving.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, organizing the South.
And I did that until I really got into full-time work here at the center. And then once I was hired as the assistant director, because I was hired first as a graduate student, then as assistant director, and then as the director. And by the time that I was the assistant director, and really I was de facto director at that time because we didn't have one, I just had too much on my plate to keep doing the Safe Schools North Carolina stuff. So.
Great. Well, I'm glad we got that.
Yeah.